Hello, Social Chemist listeners. It's been a while, hasn't it, since the last time I published an episode. To update you, I'm finishing my final semester of my MSW program at Rutgers, so I've been stacked with major assignments. Who would have figured that when trying to manage graduate school, an internship, and work, that time becomes a precious commodity? Anyway, I've completed two of my three major assignments required to graduate, and so I found some spare time to bring on some guests to understand misinformation, conspiracy theories, and extremism. In the last episode, we spoke to Matt and Tawny Browning, who gave us their personal experience in combating white supremacy as an undercover in the US. We learned about the psychological toll that it took on them, and the local dilemmas that made fighting against this hateful ideology difficult. In today's episode, we will revisit this topic from a historical and public policy perspective by listening to two counterterrorism experts who will share their knowledge and recommendations for addressing far-right violence. So sit back and enjoy as we attempt to understand the state of America regarding far-right terrorism. Be sure to stay for the post-commentary after the interview, as I want to add some more context to my suggestions in addressing far-right violence. So with that being said, let's dive in. Hello, listeners. Welcome to this edition of the Social Chemist Podcast. I'm your host, Nelson, and on today's episode, we are joined by two experts in U.S. counterterrorism. First, Bruce Hoffman is a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. For almost half a century, he has been studying domestic and foreign violent political extremism. Appointed by the U.S. Congress, Bruce served as a commissioner on the Independent Commission to Review the FBI's post-9/11 response to terrorism and radicalization. He previously held the corporate chair in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency at the RAND Corporation and was director of RAND's Washington, D.C. office and vice president for external affairs. By his side, Jacob Ware, a senior researcher also at the Council of Foreign Relations, is a scholar who studies international and domestic terrorism. His work on this topic includes how radicalization has evolved in the last three generations. In addition to his work at CFR, Jacob is an adjunct professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, where he teaches a class on domestic terrorism. Earlier this year, Bruce and Jacob partner up to publish their book, God, Guns, and Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America, a book that traces the history of white supremacy from the Reconstruction era to modern-day America, how the far-right movement has evolved, and policy recommendations to combat political extremism. Bruce, Jacob, thank you for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Before we start, I wanted to say that it is an immense honor to have both of you experts on to my program. As a person that studies political extremism, it's a huge honor because in the MSW program, I feel like there isn't this much discussion on the topic. And for some context, Jacob, I messaged you in December because I was reading your other research article on the radicalization. And you had messaged me back saying that this book was being published. So I was like, great, you know, let's discuss this topic. And I decided to go on Amazon. And when I looked at how many pages were on the book, Amazon informed me that there were 400 pages. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of words I have to read and process. But it's not anything that my graduate program hasn't prepared me for. But when I received the book, I realized that half the book is the actual content that we will be discussing today. And the other half is the references and the bibliography. So my question for you is, what was it like for both of you to research such a heavy topic like white supremacy, white nationalism, and political extremism? And what were the challenges, if any, in publishing this book?
Well, as you note, Nelson, about a third of the book our citations in the bibliography, and that was deliberate because we thought this is such an emotional and often such a contentious and controversial subject that we had to be as well armed with facts as possible. So wherever we could, we have multiple references or citations for the arguments that we're putting forward, often by other scholars, but also we use a lot of primary source information, reports from the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, as well as court transcripts. And of course, the value of court transcripts is that you swear an oath to tell the truth, the whole truth. And there's also people who testify have been subject to depositions, sort of cross-examination. So we wanted to be as well armored as possible because we realized people may disagree, and we want to show that this is a factual book. So it's deliberately so by intention, it's very well resourced, as you yourself noted.
I think one of the advantages for me, Nelson, writing this book is collaborating with somebody who is one of the great historians, certainly of terrorism, if not of American history writ large. Somebody who can conduct deep archival study, who has an enormous library that he can take advantage of, made it easy for me because I really covered. So our book, as you know, Nelson, covers really almost like 150 years of history. And I really only did like the last 15 years of that, focusing on the acceleration of the violent far right in the Obama, Trump and Biden years. And so I was able to focus more on this kind of social media primary source research and trying to take all of that deep historical study that Bruce led the way on and apply it to a more modern context. And so I think we make a good team in that regard.
Go on, Nelson.
I was going to comment that the book was excellent, very informative. There were aspects of it that, as I will bring up later on in the conversation, we're chilling. But the first couple of chapters focus on the far right's development during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, which I'm sure that Bruce covered, and then the social media aspects of it with Facebook, Gab, 4chan, which are the stuff that you covered, Jacob.
Well, you know, going back to one thing, Jacob triggered a thought. So your next question leads perfectly to what I wanted to add is, oddly enough, I first started studying violent far-right extremism 43 years ago in 1981. When I started work as an analyst, that was my first account. And being a historian, I hold on to things. So I had a lot of the materials and a lot of my notes from the 1980s and 1990s when I was very much focused on this issue. And that's, I mean, there's a 41-year age gap between Jacob and myself. So it made sense for me to take the older material that I was familiar with, and it made sense for Jacob to take the more modern material, especially that relied on social media and technology. But also, as I just said, I had all my notes, and I had all the original documents from back then too. And that was the whole purpose of the book, was to trace the trajectory of violent far-right extremism to trace the trajectory of violent far-right extremism from what we saw in the 1980s, its emergence. You know, it existed obviously since the Civil War for 130 or 120 years before that. But the point was, up until the 1980s, it was predominantly about hate and intolerance, basically racism. And then the racism broadened out to anti-Semitism, to anti-Catholicism, to xenophobia. But the difference is, in the 1980s, in addition to all of those other motivations, there emerged a very salient extremist anti-government attitude. And that's what we really saw crystallize on January 6, 2021, that same anti-government extremism, that same opposition to Washington. Back then, they didn't call it the swamp. They called it ZOG, Z-O-G, the Zionist occupation government, because it fed into their conspiracy theories that Jewish people, liberals, bankers, and other elites were controlling the world. And that's really the the core of the book is that this anti-government extremism that we saw so visibly on January 6th had existed for four decades before. The difference was it was much more isolated, geographically disparate, but in the era of social media, it could coalesce. It could gain a center of gravity or gain traction that it lacked previously. And that's what really, I think, happened on January 6th and why we see it as part of a continuum rather than an aberration or a culmination.
Now, throughout the book, you guys include excerpts from the Turner Diaries. Why is this book and literature so important in understanding white nationalism, and whether the literature that I just cited, whether it continues to have reference or influence in contemporary extremist ideology?
Well, I'll start with the Turner Diaries, but Jacob should come in and talk about accelerationism and the Great Replacement Theory, because those are definitely derivations. Turner Diaries was written by someone named Andrew McDonald, but that was just the pen name of a longstanding neo-Nazi named William Luther Pierce. And Pierce was an interesting character. He attended Caltech University, one of the finest science universities in the United States, but he ultimately graduated from University of Oregon with his BS and then his graduate degrees, including a PhD in physics. So he was not an uneducated, stupid person. He was quite intelligent. And even he realized, as head of the National Alliance, which was a neo-Nazi organization in the United States, based outside of Washington, D.C., in fact, even he realized that there was just a limited audience for the, you know, constant regurgitation or repetition of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf and other Nazi propaganda. So he had what really was the brilliant idea of writing a novel that he believed would appeal to far more people. And in 1978, he wrote this very dystopian novel that talks about a fictional group, The Order, that it, as life imitates art, there was a real life order that was active in the 1980s. That stages a revolution in the United States, a race revolution that's designed to overthrow this corrupt, elite, liberal United States government and put in place an authoritarian regime that transforms the United States into a homogeneous nation. In other words, a country that exists only for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And his success, I think, is evidenced by the fact that the Turner Diaries is estimated to have sold between 250,000 and 500,000 copies, which any author would love. In fact, you could get a copy of the Turner Diaries until about a week after January 6, 2021 on Amazon.com. It was very readily available. And this novel, one of the climactic scenes in it is the bombing of the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., the Hoover Building. And in that scenario, it was a truck bomb that's introduced into the underground parking garage that blows up the building. But that was exactly the blueprint for Timothy McVeigh's 1995 bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City that until 9/11 was the most lethal terrorist attack in America's history. It killed 168 persons. Now, there was not an underground garage at the Murrah Building, so McVeigh just parked his truck next to the building and basically took the entire building down. But that was yet another example of how life imitated art. And this terrible novel inspired the worst act of terrorism in the United States and also led to accelerationism and Great Replacement, which Jacob should talk about.
So Nelson, accelerationism is a strategy of terrorism that advocates for acts of violence that will advance some kind of cataclysmic or apocalyptic collapse in order for a new world to be built in the aftermath in the extremist's eyes. That concept was advanced by the Turner Diaries, and we now see that feature very prominently in the modern movement in a lot of the acts of violence that they see. For example, accelerationists often issue some kind of declaration that there is no political solution. And that was precisely the mentality or mindset that drove the actors in the Turner Diaries. The other, I guess, ideological element that I think is advanced by the Turner Diaries, but certainly not pioneered by it, is this concept of replacement theory, or the Great Replacement, which is a conspiracy theory that holds that there is a deliberate replacement ongoing of, I suppose, Western white Christian masculinity that is being operationalized through immigration, minority political rights, LGBTQ rights, but it's being not just accidental, but it's being deliberately coordinated by an internal enemy, such as Jews, Marxists, feminists. A lot of the acts of violence that we've seen over the past 15 years that we chronicle in the book, whether it's a twin attack in Oslo in 2019 or the 2011, or the Charleston shooting in 2015, or Charlottesville in 2017, or Pittsburgh in 2018, Christchurch, Poway, and El Paso in 2019, Buffalo 2022, Jacksonville 2023, are inspired by that replacement theory and are driven by that accelerationist strategy, that intent to accelerate, speed up some kind of collapse.
Throughout the book mentions a couple of people that were influential in the white supremacy movement. These include William Potter Gale, Lois Beam, and Timothy McVeigh. Well, Timothy McVeigh didn't hold a position of power, but one of the things that they all had in common was that they had military experience. And while I was reading the book, I wonder if the U.S. military has a problem of far-right extremism. And if it does, has it addressed it, or has it established any intervention to address this problem?
So yes, we find that there is a close relationship between the military and the extremist movement, but it's more nuanced than one might think. If you think about the stages at which an extremist with a military background can radicalize, there are really three stages. So you can radicalize before your service. So you are a white supremacist, or you are an anti-government extremist, and you seek to enter the military. You can radicalize during active duty. So as, you know, a soldier in the army, you are exposed to extremist beliefs and you radicalize. Or you can radicalize after your service. So you can radicalize as a veteran, sometimes right decades after you've left the military. We find overwhelmingly that you're talking about the first and the third category of people. So people who are extremists before their service and then seek to infiltrate the military. So a good example of this is Eric Rudolph, who perpetrated the Atlanta Olympic Park bombing. He was a longstanding white supremacist and especially anti-abortion extremist who sought to enter the military for the training, thinking that a civil war was coming and he would be better prepared. And then the other category we find a lot is veterans. So Lewis Beam, who you mentioned, is a great example of somebody who radicalized or was certainly a racist from early age, but accelerated in his radicalization after service, in part because of post-traumatic stress disorder and grievances against the government due to his service in Vietnam. There are steps being taken on this issue, but Bruce and I have been critical in some of our writing about the administration's policies on this issue. For example, we find that the military-wide stand-down, which seems to be the major policy initiative, so a 60-day stand-down to talk about extremism in every unit, that really targets that middle category, active duty soldiers who are radicalizing. We find that's not really part of the problem. You'd be better off looking to better screen out individuals who seek to enter the service as white supremacists through things like tattoo databases or social media scans as part of background checks. And then we find that you really need to drastically ramp up veterans support, because for a variety of reasons, veterans are being preyed upon by extremist groups who are seeking their training and weapons expertise, communications expertise, knowledge of insurgency and counterinsurgency tactics. And we need to do a much better job of protecting that community of former service members from being vulnerable to that kind of radicalization and recruitment.
When one thinks about the mass shootings that have been influenced by great replacement theory, at face value, one would think that these individuals are just causing harm just to cause harm. They just want to take away life. But there's more to it. And I think you guys perfectly described this. Now, in chapter six, there's a quote in there that says, terrorism is violence being communicated. When it comes to these active shooters that engage in violence, what is the end goal? Because it's more than just taking away life. There's some ideological movement. They're trying to share something with other people. Can you dive a little bit into that?
Well, I mean, terrorism, it was said, gosh, 40 years ago, as a form of violent communication. I mean, the media often portrays it as homicidal, mindless violence by irrational fanatics. But all terrorism is planned, premeditated, and purposeful. In other words, the people involved in it have an idea what they're doing. It's cause and effect. They want to attract attention to themselves and to their cause. And violence, unfortunately, does so. You know, in traditional media, there's an old saying or an aphorism: if it bleeds, it leads, which is certainly true. I would say, though, that even when we have acts of violence like mass shooting that may be perpetrated by people with mental illness or with some mental instability, the grafting onto it of an altruistic motive, of a desire to frame it in political terms, makes it easier for them to justify, to themselves at least, the commission of that violence, because they see that they're doing something good. They see themselves as, you know, the ultimate sacrifice for a broader belief system. So for them, the killing and bloodshed is intrinsic to getting attention, and attention is the reason that they're carrying out these acts of violence.
I'm going to talk a little bit about social media and its influence on white supremacy. Now, when it comes to conspiracy theories, during the height of the pandemic, there was a number of mainstream articles claiming that we were living in the golden age of conspiracy theories. But if you look at the research, conspiracy theories have always existed. This is not a phenomenon that social media has invented. And I think the same thing can be said about far-right extremism. But in your book, you again explain perfectly how social media has helped evolve the white supremacy movement. So during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, for people to find these ideologies, they would have to find an organization or find a group of people. And that would involve sometimes, you know, traveling across state lines, which involved money and time. But with social media, it's kind of removed that. Can you talk a little bit about how social media has helped the white supremacy movement evolve from a organizational movement to a more of a lone gunman or an individualistic movement? I guess that's a good way of putting it.
Well, I think, you know, it's always been a movement that's been composed of lone wolves or lone actors, as well as organizations. What knits them together as an enabling ideology, because Timothy McVeigh didn't belong to any organization, wasn't following anyone's orders. I mean, he enlisted a couple of army buddies or former army buddies essentially to carry out the attack. So he was like the archetype of the lone wolf, even, you know, almost 30 years ago. I think the difference is it was hit or miss because the numbers were so small, whether you could radicalize and ultimately motivate and inspire and animate someone like Timothy McVeigh. Today with social media, it's just much easier to do. For instance, this movement started out in the 1980s in order to obviate FBI wiretaps and other kinds of surveillance by using what was then a new and novel technology. It was desktop computers that only had about 48K memory, which is probably a letter or a numeral on a PowerPoint slide today. And then, you know, you couldn't have photographs or even moving images like today. You had modems that had 80 or 160 baud rate that was very slow in uploading basically an email message. And this was very cumbersome. Desktop computers in the 1980s were very expensive compared to, well, forget the cost of computers. I mean, we have handheld phones that do that. And everybody's got a computer that's, you know, infinitely or exponentially more powerful than that 48K desktop decades ago. So the reach was very limited. With social media, You can communicate in real time. It's inexpensive. It's ubiquitous. Once you post it on a Telegram channel or some other 8chan or 4kun, you know, you basically, it's up there forever. And you can communicate far more effectively and far wider than you ever could before. So social media has proven to be a tremendous boon to this movement. Because also, too, ideas and thoughts that were once unacceptable have become, you know, legitimized and much more commonplace today than they ever were. And there's various reasons for that. I mean, firstly, politicians or elected officials repeatedly give top cover to some of these odious views, which we would have never seen in past decades. But also, too, I think the ubiquity of these messages on social media creates a power of numbers so that the people who believe in these things don't feel embarrassed any longer or feel they can't say them. They found a community that agrees with them and that, in fact, not only agrees with them, but often eggs them on into even greater excesses.
I loved what you said, Nelson, about conspiracy theories aren't new. I think social media is a connector, as Bruce said, and an accelerant. And the group or network that I thought of immediately when you said that was QAnon. QAnon, for I'm sure your listeners are familiar, but it's basically a network of people that says that President Trump was divinely chosen to rid various communities, whether the Democratic Party or the media or banks or Hollywood, of Satan worshipping child sex trafficking pedophiles. That conspiracy theory is extremely anti-Semitic in my mind. It's actually like a modern incarnation of the protocols of the Elders of Zion and like blood libel. So you're taking these, in some cases, centuries old anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, you're repackaging them in ways that are quite subtle and clever into modern contexts and disseminating them on a massive scale, to the extent that you've got millions of people who are following Q's every beck and call. I think that's just a really good way of highlighting how social media is a very powerful tool at making these conspiracy theories much more widespread, much more normalized, and integrated in various ways in modern society.
When it comes to regulating social media, that is a challenging discussion. Now, some have argued that the government should play a role in that, but for one, if you're anti-government, that kind of reinforces the ideology that you believe in. The next thing is that these social media platforms should self-regulate, and sometimes they do. Facebook, for example, after January 6th, and Twitter removed a lot of QAnon content. Trump was banned from Twitter until he came back. But one of the limitations of the self-regulation method is that most of the people that become radicalized aren't getting radicalized on Facebook or on Instagram. They're getting radicalized on websites like Truth Social, Gab, Telegram. I mean, Patron Dentrin, when he committed his act of violence, killing the 10 African-Americans, they found out that much of his ideology was developed on 4chan. And yet these platforms have no incentive to, you know, stop the engagement that they create in their platforms. From a policy perspective, how do you address that, if you can?
It is a real challenge. And you're right to say that sometimes social media companies police themselves. Certainly, in an ideal world, they would police themselves better. Bruce and I think our guiding framework for our recommendations on social media is that social media companies have basically lost the right to determine for themselves at this point what is and is not an appropriate amount of moderation. So in our case, we call for reform of Section 230, which is part of the Communications Decency Act, which protects social media companies basically from being held liable on their platform for content on their platforms. So right now, for example, you can't sue Facebook for participating in the radicalization of somebody who murdered one of your family members. Right. There have been Supreme Court cases that have tested that recently, and they were struck down. We argue that that should not be the case because really the two things that you need are content moderation. So legitimately removing content that is dangerous or inflammatory, or divisive in any particularly dangerous ways. And then you need algorithm reform. So right now, algorithms on a lot of social media platforms aim to keep people on those platforms and therefore drive them towards increasingly shocking or interesting or surprising content that is contributing to radicalization in places like YouTube, right? So we argue that you need to think about content moderation, you need to think about algorithm reform, and because social media companies have been reluctant to do that themselves, yes, you need to think about Section 230 reform. Now, all of that focuses on what we call, well, the supply of extremist content, right? So all of that is focused on how much extremist content exists, should be allowed to exist on social media platforms. There's also a demand problem, and there's also a reality that there is a demand for extremist content for whatever reason, whether it's deliberate, whether people want that content, or more inadvertent. As in they're vulnerable to that kind of content, and they're vulnerable to the information that is to the mis and disinformation on those sites. So we also think about in our book about ways to address demand of extremist material. For example, one thing in that space is digital literacy or media literacy programming. So educating people or training them on how to spot and dismiss bad information, misinformation, disinformation online, for example, by conducting lateral reading. So if you read something on a social media site that is kind of unbelievable, odds are it actually probably is unbelievable. And you need to understand how to go seek an alternative source from a different political angle and verify that information by double checking it. So that kind of stuff. We advocate for in order to try to build a more resilient populace against these kind of bad information. I imagine actually this gets into your realm more of the social work element. So I'd be curious actually for your thoughts if you guys think about this at all in your field, what this would look like, how you implement it. Because I think Nelson too, like you're right that if you ask the government to crack down on social media, then it is going to feed into those conspiracy theories, right? And you're almost going to build into this self-reinforcing loop. So we have to think about how do we break out of that loop and try to find alternative measures to counter that kind of information.
You know, I would add, sorry, Nelson.
Oh, I was going to comment. When it comes to social work, as I mentioned before, there's not much on it, but we do have a role in that, which is, it was the question I was going to ask you, but I guess I'll answer it. So when it comes to conspiracy theories, we know that when people fall into these narratives, for the most part, it's because their psychological needs aren't being met. We saw this especially during the QAnon movement. A lot of people were on lockdown. They were uncertain about what was going on. And what they had was social media. And because the algorithm boosted content that was shocking, a lot of the people ended up getting radicalized. I mean, one of the things that social workers can do is create programs that address people's economic status, issues that are concerned about their living conditions, their access to healthcare, stuff of that nature. The issue, however, with any social work program is funding. It's something that we as a collective in the social profession needs to work on.
We do find that there is a, especially in the last kind of 10 to 15 years, that there is a surprisingly high number or repetition of what you might call vulnerabilities. So I think you said psychological needs. We find high levels of youth, definitely, but we find high levels of histories of being bullied, histories of loneliness and isolation, histories of mental health issues, especially autism spectrum disorder. Violence in the home, histories of parental suicide, sometimes economic conditions, all of which I think adds up to that, what you might call a typology of vulnerability that needs to be addressed at some point. Now, it's controversial because we are dealing with really vicious ideologies here, like, you know, true white supremacy. And it is controversial to say, you know, in some of these cases, there were mental health issues that played a role. We have to, I think, be able to have that conversation without giving the impression that we're trying to ignore these ideologies, right? The ideologies are real. The violence is real. They are, white supremacy has a long-standing history in our country. It's embedded in our national culture. That's all absolutely true. But it is being fed to people with certain vulnerabilities to that ideology for whatever reason, to radicalization for whatever reason. We need to be able to address that that head on. Back to you, Bruce.
Well, no, I was just going to add, when Nelson was talking about, you know, the excellent question about whether government restrictions on social media doesn't fan, you know, government, you know, censorship or intervention. I mean, one thing we talk about in the book is the 2019 online harms white paper that the British Home Office and Ministry for culture, sport, and digital media released. And this laid out very effectively, I think, what government's responsibilities are to its citizens in the digital era, not just to keep them safe from political extremism, but from harassment, from bullying, from shaming, from human trafficking, from pedophilia. And it recognized that a lot of the optimism about the internet from the 1990s, that it would be a force of education and enlightenment and would make the truth accessible to everyone, has not materialized. I mean, in many cases, it's been the opposite. And it recognized that government can't be laissez-faire, but that also in democracies, governments have to protect freedom of expression. So at least in the United Kingdom, they're having this debate and discussion. And in the United States, you know, we're not even close to that.
I want to touch a little bit on polarization in the U.S. Now, in the book, you guys comment that there's experts that believe that we are heading towards a civil war, and that tends to have apocalyptic consequences. However, apocalyptic consequences isn't anything that we're unfamiliar with here in the U.S. So, for example, back in 2016, when Donald Trump won the presidency, a lot of people said that it was going to be the end of democracy in the U.S., but that didn't happen. In 2020, the COVID-19 lockdowns occurred. Again, people thought that that was going to be the end of the world, but we pushed through it. Then there was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, where political commentators were talking about nuclear war and that we were all going to die, but that never occurred. And I would argue that one of the reasons why these, you know, apocalyptic consequences never occur, quote unquote, is because society is more complex. We have more entertainment than we did prior to the Civil War back in the 1800s. And so my question for you is, are we in danger of a civil war based on the polarization that we're seeing, or has it been exaggerated a little bit?
I think it's been exaggerated. It may be one of the most optimistic notes that we sound in the book, in that Jacob and I don't think a civil war, like the American Civil War of the 1860s, occurred. I mean, firstly, it's not as simple as a North-South divide. It's not even as simple as a red-blue state divide. I mean, we know that, you know, many of the people who showed up on January 6th were from urban, not rural areas, and often were from cities in the north or even from purple states. So it you're right to say society's become much more complex and complicated. So I don't think we're in danger of a civil war, but, you know, I hearken back to what Thomas Jefferson said, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And we have to be vigilant. We have to understand that, you know, even though that long list of developments that people predicted would have dire consequences may not have materialized individually, in concatenation or together or over time, they could erode the tenets of democracy and could undermine the strength of the United States. And for that reason, what Jacob and I worry about is something along the lines of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, where you have sporadic, but nonetheless over time, sustained outbursts of terrorism throughout the country, perpetrated by the discontent in the United States, who have, I mean, it's just a, it's, this isn't an editorial statement one way or the other on the Second Amendment or on gun control, but it's a fact that the United States is the most armed country in the world. I mean, there's roughly 121 firearms per 100 persons in the U.S. Number two on that list. And by the way, the next the U.S. has more firearms than the next 25 countries on the list of armed citizens. Number two on that list is a country that we associate right now in the news as being extraordinarily violent. That's Yemen, you know, with the Houthis and the unrest there. Well, there's only 53 firearms per 100 population in Yemen. So the United States is more than double that. So in other words, if you want to engage in violence in the U.S., it's pretty easy to do so. It's easier than in most countries because the weaponry is readily available. We don't see an organized civil war as much as the potential for organized terrorist attacks, or even terrorist attacks that aren't coordinated and part of a master plan, but inspire one another and are deliberately undertaken to motivate copycats. And this is something that our former boss at the Council on Foreign Relations, Dr. Richard Haass, who actually was for many years the United States' chief negotiator in Northern Ireland. I mean, in his latest book, he also talks about the danger of the Troubles coming to the United States because of the political polarization, because of the divisions in this country, because of a recent University of Maryland and Washington Post poll that over the past 3 years has repeatedly shown that roughly a third of Americans in a democracy nonetheless believe that in certain circumstances it might be justified to use violence against the federal government. Now, it tends to be more Republicans than Democrats, but the difference between them isn't huge. I mean, unfortunately, we've got, you know, roughly 30%, let's say, of this country that now feels it's perfectly legitimate to take up arms against their government, which to me is unthinkable in a democracy where there's elections. But I think that underscores that Dr. Haass's and Jacob and my arguments about, you know, the potential for more widespread terrorism are indeed, you know, there is some foundation for that assessment.
When it comes to white nationalism, I feel like we can't talk about this without bringing up one individual, and that person is Tucker Carlson. Now, Tucker Carlson has been, accused of mainstreaming the white supremacy movement. In the past, in his program, he promoted the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which has been well documented by the New York Times. He spread the Big Lie conspiracy theory, which during the Dominion lawsuit, during the deposition, was discovered that while he was promoting this conspiracy theory, he himself did not believe in it. And as a matter of fact, he also claimed that he hated Donald Trump. He's also interviewed individuals like Alex Jones, who I know doesn't need an introduction. And recently, he interviewed Vladimir Putin, which has been a fan favorite from my observation by the far right. So my question for you is, does Tucker Carlson have a role in the spread of white nationalism? And if he does, what is that role? And feel free to disagree with me if you don't agree with that assessment.
I'll respond by saying, and then I'll turn it over to you, Bruce, that we focus in our book on terrorism and the facets that contribute to terrorism. So we focus on radicalization and violence itself and counterterrorism. Tucker Carlson doesn't necessarily figure into that picture because he's not himself a terrorist, right? Terrorists are violent, and that's kind of, you know, the key difference. Now, I will note that I agree with you. Tucker Carlson is contributing to the advancement and the mainstreaming of elements of white supremacy, especially Great Replacement Theory. He had a tweet on January 22nd to 13 million people where he spoke about how everyone from the White House to the Supreme Court had decided to destroy the country by allowing it to be invaded. And that leaves the population to defend itself. Where are the men of Texas? He asked. And I looked at that tweet and I was able to pull out two direct language connections to the manifesto written by the white supremacist terrorist who murdered 23 Latino shoppers at an El Paso, a Walmart in El Paso in August 2019. So when Tucker Carlson says, "Where are the men of Texas?" you know, deliberately or inadvertently, I believe he is making reference to or making invitations to that kind of act of violence. And that's a problem. It's reckless at best to use that kind of rhetoric, to use the rhetoric that our country's being invaded and we must defend ourselves. Reckless at best, incitement at worst. And so I think even though he doesn't feature a lot in our book because our book is, has a narrow focus on terrorism, he is contributing to this broader environment and this broader culture, I think, of division and hatred.
Final question and simple one. Where do you see the state of America going forward based on your research on far-right terrorism and the potential presidency of Donald Trump? Are you optimistic that we as a society will overcome this ideology and terrorism, or are you more in the pessimistic realm?
I think what worries us the most, and this is reflected in the cover of the book, is that this isn't just violence of one party directed against another party, or, I mean, of extremists claiming to represent one party against another party. That's a more accurate portrayal of this. This is just a threat to our democracy because, you know, on the cover of our book, we have the gallows that was erected in front of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. That was specifically for a sitting vice president who happened to be a Republican and a Christian evangelical. And this is the problem. It's a movement that doesn't brook any disagreement, that imposes a rigidity of thought, which after all is authoritarianism. And I'm talking about extreme far-right violence, that if you don't agree with them, even if you're of their party, even if you're of their race, even if you're of their religion, they're going to target you. And we've seen this recently in even senatorial campaigns, where Republican candidates for Senate have issued rhino licenses, in other words, rhino hunting licenses for, to hunt down Republicans in name only. So we're seeing our democracy erode with this sense of intolerance that isn't only predicated on race, religion, gender, as it's traditionally been, but now it's predicated on an intolerance even within a single party for anyone who doesn't toe a very rigid and strict line. And that can only be worrisome. It means that the heart of politics and the heart of democracy, which is debate and discourse, is really being stifled.
It's interesting. It's an indictment, to Bruce's point, it's an indictment of the state of our democracy that the only minority candidate, at least of a, you know, mainstream party that's running in this election, Nikki Haley, is being targeted with death threats and has requested Secret Service protection, right? That's the state of the party. So when you have a Republican who dares to go against the orthodoxy, dares to go against the leader of the kind of proclaimed leader of that party, rather than being disagreed with on a debate stage, the perceived legitimate way to deal with that candidacy now is through violent threats and through threats to assassinate her. So that's very concerning. Now, I will tell you, Nelson, Bruce and I have gone back and forth and back and forth on a key question, which is, from a raw terrorism point of view, is it better to have a Joe Biden victory, given everything that means for election denialism, or is it better to have a Trump victory, given everything that means for the perceived sense of empowerment within elements of this violent far-right movement? I don't know what the answer to that question is from a raw kind of, you know, not political, but from a raw counterterrorism standpoint. I think the answer is either way, we're going to have violence. That's the state of the nation. And that's very concerning. And so we're in for a rocky year in the domestic terrorism space, I believe. And, you know, I'm grateful to people like you, to be honest, who are trying to participate in educating people about these important issues and trying to make a difference in your own community.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And there's so much that we can talk about, but we're running short out of time. So Bruce, Jacob, again, thank you so much for sharing your expertise, your knowledge as a graduate student that is interested in this field. I cannot thank you enough for your work, your contribution. It is helpful for graduate students like me. So thank you so much.
No, you're very welcome, Nelson. Thank you for inviting us to be on the podcast.
Thank you.
And before that, I forgot to mention, where can the listeners find your work?
X and Blue Sky. Bruce and I both post everything that we write and that where we speak on those sites. We also have we both have profile pages at our home institution, the Council on Foreign Relations, where we post our recent work. So please do check that out. And I will just note, if I may, Nelson, I will just note that Bruce and I poured our blood, sweat, and tears over 4 years into, as you noted, about 450 pages worth of writing. So I would recommend anybody is interested in this topic to please check out our book and feel free to reach out if you have any questions.
No problem. And for the listeners, the book is called God, Guns, and Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America. Jacob, Bruce, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Nelson.
Hi there. I hope you found today's discussion with Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware informative. I want to spend a couple of minutes revisiting the section of the interview where I offer my suggestions on how social workers can address far-right extremism and extremism in general, since I feel I didn't expand on my thoughts. As stated earlier, I believe that addressing income inequality and access to healthcare are factors that can mitigate desperation and anxiety. By improving a person's well-being, they are less likely to rely on misinformation and political extremism to understand their sense of insecurity and blame others, like the Jews, for the disparity. The reason why I also mentioned healthcare was when I was responding to Jacob, I was thinking of the anti-vaccine extremists that have harassed public health workers because, in their mind, the doctors are in collusion with a plot to depopulate the world. If perhaps healthcare in the U.S. were not so expensive and inaccessible, people will rely less on health misinformation, which can then lead to extremism, which then can lead to terrorism. I hope this explainer adds more context to my contribution to the discussion. If you want more insight into Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware's work, I will provide the link in the show notes below and the link to their book, God's Gone Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to subscribe and leave me a 5-star review. By doing so, you help expose this podcast to people who might be interested in conspiracy theories and extremism within politics. If you're listening on any other platform, be sure to subscribe to get more analysis on the conspiratorial mindset. You can follow me on Thread and on Instagram at The Social Chemist. You can find me on Substack for my newsletter. The references for this episode can be found in the show notes below. Be sure to share today's episode to have some interesting discussions about U.S. far-right terrorism. So with that being said, take care, be safe, and question everything with logic. Thank you.